We already have more than 15,000 people detained since the start of the war. But almost every day we have people on the streets because they're desperate. I mean, they keep seeing those pictures from Ukraine and they think they have to demonstrate that it is not done in their name and they want to stop it. Even those who used to be like completely depoliticized are now only thinking about pulling the brakes. We have to get away from this nightmare.
Hey guys, thank you all for tuning into your weekly Dissens podcast. In this week's episode, I'm joined by a very special guest, by Greg Yudin, who is one of the most prominent voices of the Russian anti-war protests. Greg Yudin is a sociologist, philosopher, and professor at the Moscow School of Social and Economic Sciences. And we're going to talk about Putin's invasion, but also about the prospects of the anti-war movement in Russia. Greg, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Greg, you're part of an anti-war movement that has emerged in Russia since Putin has started his invasion. Last week and again, thousands of Russians took to the streets to protest against Putin's war. Hundreds were arrested. You yourself have been arrested previously. Maybe you can tell us a bit about what's the situation and the atmosphere like in Russia.
Well, I think a lot of people are still pretty much in denial on what is going on with our own country, but obviously also with Ukraine and also with Belarus. People still pretend that the life is more or less as usual, except, of course, the long lines at banks. And if you want, for instance, to withdraw currency, it is limited. And those problems with the banks, the rising prices, in some places, stores are running out of goods. Those are the first cracks in this stable everyday life that Russians are used to. But mostly, I think, still everyone pretends, or not everyone, but a lot of people pretend to live like they used to. Mm. And of course, at the same time, you have a lot of people who are fleeing the country because of the fears of martial law. And at the same time, you have some very, very alarming demonstrations of the new nature of this regime. You have the people who are threatened by the secret services, by the authorities. And some of those people find the Z letters on their doors. And the Z letter, of course, is the symbol of this invasion. It's painted on part of Russian military vehicles, which are now in Ukraine, and it is used now widely inside Russia as a military symbol. So you find those Z letters on the doors. You will see people, students or civil servants, who are forced to do these installations to assemble in the shape of the Z letter. And you will find, of course, a lot of intimidation and a lot of pressure in the universities, in the schools, the working places, warning people about the consequences if they participate in anti-war rallies, but also instructing them about the causes behind these operations. So I would generally wrap it up saying that this is some sort of mix of denial, fear, and defiance.
Yeah, well, defiance is a good word, I guess, because it takes courage to protest the war right now in Russia. Greg, can you tell us a bit more about the anti-war protest itself? Who is part of this anti-war movement and how big is it actually?
Well, the first polls taken immediately after the war started indicated that up to 25% of the respondents were opposed to this war. Now this number is going down, but this is going down because we are increasingly in a totalitarian state. And of course, under these conditions, the numbers no longer make sense. I mean, some people flee, some people are silenced. Mm-hmm. But those 20-25%, they are mostly, I would say, what I would call a progressive class. A very broad term, perhaps, but it conveys sometimes a strange mix of the people who are in one way or another embedded in the global community, in the global culture. They are part of the global cultural flows, global economic flows, so they basically see Russia as part of the global community. They tend to be younger, and according to the same polls, there's a split among the young people on the attitude to this military operation, whereas the elderly overwhelmingly support it. in addition to being younger, they tend to be more concentrated in big cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg, but also Novosibirsk, Yekaterinburg, Irkutsk. All of these cities have seen pretty large anti-war rallies. Mm-hmm. These people tend to be more educated, and obviously they tend to be less dependent on the TV channels, because the TV audience is, of course, overwhelmingly supporting any action undertaken by the government. Yeah, and interestingly, one of the studies demonstrates that those who are worse off are more likely to be against this war, probably because they understand that they will pay the price with the money, but also with the lives of their children. Yet another thing that I could add about this movement is it is pretty stubborn. We already have more than 15,000 people detained since the start of the war.
15,000? That's so crazy. What happens to those people?
Yeah, 15,000. Most of them were released. After that, some of them were sentenced to like 5 or 10 days in jail. Most of them were simply fined, which is relatively soft for Russia. But we have also seen several occasions when the police stations, people were heavily beaten up and even sexually assaulted. So that happened already several times. And from what we have heard from those police officers who were exerting this violence, they feel like they now have license to do whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. But still, this sort of violence, I mean, it's very, very concerning, but it seems to be limited. And for that reason, perhaps people on the streets keep gathering almost every day. Now it tends to focus mainly on Sundays, but almost every day we have people on the streets. They're being detained, they're being fined, and well, basically they face the risk of criminal prosecution, because according to Russian laws, if you participate in a rally 3 times, it's already a criminal case and it's up to 5 years in prison. And now we have additional laws passed by the parliament and signed by the president, according to which you risk up to 15 or 20 years in prison. Well, honestly, I don't remember what for, but the idea is that if you are against the war and you demonstrate that.
When we look at the level of repression that we're seeing now by state authorities in Russia, what's your explanation, Greg, for why are so many Russians still willing to risk so much in order to protest the war?
So they're taking those serious risks, well, for 2 reasons, I think. One of them is because they're desperate. I mean, they keep seeing those pictures from Ukraine and they think that something should be done immediately. Something has to be done. They have to do something. They can't stay home. And the other reason is that we feel like there's nothing left to lose, basically, that our country is no more, that everything we have invested in Russia, everything we were trying to build in Russia, and honestly, we built quite a lot. Could have done better, of course, under better conditions, but still, it ceases to exist because Russia is supposed to be cut off from the global community. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of thing that these people find very difficult to swallow. And for that reason, they are willing to take those risks, to go out on the streets, and basically having no hope for real support from abroad, nobody would step up for them, but is still willing to demonstrate that it is not done in their name and they want to stop it to save Russia they love.
Yeah, obviously it's fucking brave what you and everybody in the anti-war movement is doing in Russia. So solidarity goes out to you guys. But talk a bit more, Greg, about the parts of the population that are actively supporting the war or that are passive out of fear or denial. So what's the sentiment towards the war in the more general population and what role does the state propaganda play?
Well, people sometimes misapprehend how Russian propaganda works. I often hear people saying, well, the TV audience is simply brainwashed and not willing to accept the truth. This is not simply about being brainwashed. Actually, Russians are taught very well not to trust anyone, including, of course, the propaganda. So people might be very skeptical of the propaganda. But one thing propaganda does, and this is the most important thing, I guess, is that it reconciles the audience with the inability to act. Because the rule number one for any Russian is there is no possible way you can change anything. Nothing depends on you. You should never ever try changing anything. Whatever you do might only make things worse for you and for people around you and for the rest. So basically, propaganda functions as justifications for not acting. It provides people with what they need to explain to themselves why they are not acting. Deep inside, of course, a major part of this TV audience understands that these are, of course, lies. But it is simply unbearable to understand that your country is waging a war on your brothers, basically, because Ukrainians, of course, are brothers and Russians keep believing in that. So it is like psychologically, like mentally, it is much easier to deny this, to use all the propaganda feeds you to deny this reality and to stick to this picture provided by the state TV. And this is where the denial comes from, because it's just very difficult for a human being to bear, to live with, that you should be doing something immediately without any single chance to succeed. So that I think is the ground for denial. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of those who tend to generally support the actions of the government, I think it can be divided into two big groups. One of them is really aggressive. This group is willing to say this is a war. A war should be waged. This is a war against the United States. And it has to be taken to the end. This is a very aggressive group. It can be aggressive both externally and internally. It fuels the terror inside the country. While the other group, I think, might be a bit larger and limits itself to some sort of passive support. Those are people who are buying the message from the propaganda that there is no war, there's this special military operation. I mean, you have to understand that if you approach some random person on the street asking, what's your attitude to war, there's a very high chance that the answer would be, what war? There is no war. What Russia is doing is basically trying to prevent a war. This is an operation to restore peace and to avoid a war. So these people are willing to succumb to this message, to give some passive support to the actions of the president and of Russian military. Now, of course, it was supposed to be a blitzkrieg, a very quick operation, which would result in success in 3 or 4 days. That would have spared Russian government of necessity to explain in details. Now, of course, we understand that this is not the case. And there are already some cracks in this larger narrative of special operation. But the government also understands that. And therefore, we have this increase in terror, installing fear, and these people who used to provide some passive support, they are now required to become more active. And they are reacting in various ways, I'd say. Some of them are willing to agree and become more aggressive indeed, because that, once again, that helps them to preserve their mental stability. Whereas the other part starts realizing that something went wrong. Actually, I know some people who were initially in support of this operation, but just today they got back to me saying, well, now it looks like indeed there is only support for Russia in Donbass and Crimea. We should probably leave the other parts of Ukraine as they are.
So when you look at this precarious situation where you have like change of attitudes towards the war on the one hand, but also like growing repression and state terror, as you described it, what kind of scenarios do you see for the Russian anti-war movement and the Russian society in general in the near future?
I think the darkest scenario is very likely. It is transforming into full-scale totalitarian state. And I think we're very, very close to that. What I mentioned, those Z signs on the doors, those mass gatherings in Z shape, the lectures given to school kids, basically explaining the content of Putin's speech on the history of Ukraine, some episodes of violence that I've already mentioned. Yeah, and perhaps one additional thing that is very, very concerning is this denazification narrative that only emerged with the start of this war. The reason I think it is particularly alarming is that basically it provides you with absolute justification for whatever you do on the Ukrainian soil. And all those things together, all those things combined, I think indicate a very, very dangerous direction for the country. Basically transforming it into a state which would be very, very close to Germany in the 1930s. I mean, I find increasingly more similarities. It was never the case before. I never called Russia a totalitarian state. It was just a typical authoritarian regime. But now it gets much closer to the Germany of the 30s. Speaking of a better scenario, the progressive classes that I mentioned that are certainly unhappy with the war, some of them for like for moral reasons, other for maybe for economic reasons, those things you might combine. Of course, many people realize that they are losing a lot in this war without any clear perspective of gaining anything. So those progressive classes might establish some sort of alliance with part of the elites. Because these part of the elites, of course, is also now losing their lifestyle. So that might be some sort of temporary alliance between those classes. And if there is no military advance in Ukraine, no major victory in Ukraine, if those retaliation measures taken by Europe and the United States keep acting as immediate destruction of the lifestyle for these people, and if there are some cracks in the elites, then I think this could turn into some sort of political subject capable of pulling the brakes. Because a lot of people around me, even those who used to be like completely depoliticized, are now only thinking about pulling the brakes. Just stop that. We want it to go on as it used to be before February 24th. We have to get away from this nightmare. This attitude among those people who have resources, who have understanding, they are educated, they have something to lose, that might at some point translate into some sort of political action. I don't hold this scenario for basic, but there is still possibility given the difficulties this military operation ran into.
Greg, when you're saying the darker scenario is more likely, have you yourself ever thought about fleeing from your home country? And of course, you only have to answer if you want to.
I mean, to me, I have actually two considerations about that. One of them is that I'm not going to fight this war for Putin anyway. This is a betrayal of my country, and I'm not going to participate in this war. And that means that I have to avoid mobilization. Consideration number two is we have to understand what are the opportunities for some sort of political action from the inside and from the outside. If indeed the worst things start happening, if there is basically no room for any sort of meaningful resistance from the inside, then the question for me actually is whether you guys are ready to support some sort of resistance from the outside, some sort of political activism, political thinking from Russia, which would endeavor to bring about a different Russia, to understand, to explain to the people what happened to Russia over those last 20, maybe 30 years, and to support the reconfiguration of Russia. And those are the things I'm waiting right now when making this decision.
Yeah, let's hope that it doesn't go that far. But again, and I'm speaking for the whole audience of this podcast here, our solidarity goes out to you and all the people that want to put Russia on a better path. And I'd like to talk to you about how we in the West can support the Russian civil society and the democratic movement. But first, Greg, regarding the Putin regime, could you tell us a bit more about possible tipping points where Putin and his regime could lose power? You already mentioned external factors like the resistance of Ukrainians and Western sanctions, but also internal factors like the growing unrest with the invasion. So what are the key factors that could become dangerous for Putin?
Well, I think there are actually three, and you just mentioned them. There are three main factors that are putting considerable pressure on Putin's regime. One of them is the resistance from the Ukrainians, was clearly underestimated. Then there is the cohesion and unified response from the global community, also very likely underestimated. And then there is the stubbornness of those protesting, also perhaps somewhat underestimated, because we've seen some preemptive measures taken before the invasion to suppress the organization. But that measures definitely were not enough. And now we are seeing just a quick steps taken to retaliate, to stop that. There's a lot of a lot of talk about how to stop spreading fakes. And by fakes, it is meant, of course, any sort of alternative information about what's going on in Ukraine. The concern about those so-called fakes already demonstrates that the information war, even on the Russian soil, is not going well. So those are three factors that could put Putin in a precarious situation. And honestly, I don't know what are the prospects here because, well, from the military viewpoint, I'm not a military analyst, of course, but the fact that the initial plan failed, the initial plan of like taking Kyiv in 3 days and having a parade there with Ukrainians embracing Russian soldiers with flowers, was completely delusional. That plan failed, but it doesn't mean that he has no plan B. And the plan B apparently is grinding Ukrainian cities and pressing Ukrainian government, Ukrainian people into some sort of concessions. That might work. I don't know if Putin has enough time to do that. We still don't know if he has enough money, enough resources to do that. So that is one big if. Yet another big if is the response from the global community will be as coherent as it was for these several weeks. Well, imagine he steps up with this nuclear blackmail. What would be the reaction of the global community? Wouldn't it want to trade Ukraine for some sort of imagined safety, or at least preventing World War III? And then, as I mentioned, the third factor, whether those groups protesting in Russia would be affected enough to start thinking of some sort of counteraction. And that's also far from being clear, because many people are leaving the country, and that, of course, makes this anti-war movement weaker. But yet another important thing is that it can only work if these, you know, this lifestyle like changes rapidly, drastically, swiftly. Because the idea that Russians will start suffering from economic downfall gradually and that will eventually lead them on the streets, that's not going to happen. But losing their lifestyle might be a factor. And these three factors combined, I guess, might make Putin really cornered. Of course, he becomes extremely dangerous in this situation. But at some point, I think there could be some sort of opening in this situation.
Greg, I also wanted to ask you what you think brought us into this situation, because I think in order to think about a better future, we have to understand how this war came about. When it comes to the causes of the invasion, what are Putin's motivations? Is it some kind of neo-imperialism, some fear of democratization in neighboring countries, but also within his own country, or the fear of NATO pushing further east, as he claims? So what's your perspective on that?
I guess all these things actually apply. One has to understand that this is a defensive war for Putin, that he's in the defensive. He really feels threatened. And this is an existential threat. What exactly he is afraid of? Well, you have to recall the fate of Colonel Gaddafi. And we know that Putin was very, very disturbed by the, extremely disturbed by the pictures of Gaddafi being killed. So what happened to Gaddafi? Gaddafi actually faced some sort of popular movement against him, decided at some point to suppress it brutally, and was going to do that. He had enough military capabilities for doing that. And then it was NATO imposing this no-fly zone and turning the table. So this is precisely the scenario that Putin wants to avoid. Mm-hmm. When he faces this popular resistance, and there's no doubt about that, I mean, he's been losing support because people are increasingly tired of him in Russia, particularly in the younger generations. So some sort of popular uprising was imminent in Russia, just as happened in Belarus. And Belarus and Russia, they are very similar in terms of political culture. Now imagine he has this regime nearby in a culturally very close country. And then he has this regime which is militarily supported by the Americans. What would be his options on the domestic front? What would be his options when this uprising happens? Would he be threatened at this crucial moment by some sort of coercive action coming from this neighboring country? So that was a big question. And Putin was increasingly seeing Ukraine slipping away from Russian influence.
Yeah, okay. But from my perspective, that slipping away of influence seems to have manifested itself more in Ukrainians wanting to be closer to Europe and becoming more democratic, like in the Euromaidan uprising, and not so much in NATO-Ukrainian military alliance.
Yeah, I mean, it started earlier. It started in 2004 when he already had his advisors trying to prop up Yanukovych during this disputed election of 2004. And they lost. Yushchenko won. And in 2014, Putin was just felt strong enough to believe that that should not happen for the second time. We have to keep Ukraine under control. And now that you have Zelensky in office, who increasingly cooperates with the Americans on the military front, so the main danger for Putin is this military cooperation, because if there is a political regime secured and guaranteed by military means, it means that that type of regime cannot be just demolished. And this increasing cooperation that Zelensky started, I guess, in 2020 and in 2021, it made clear for Putin that if he wants to prevent Ukraine from sliding away, he has to do it now, right now. That's the last point to do that, to decide the fate of Ukraine. It will be too late just in 1 year or two, because the American military presence would be just too large. And it was realized in Moscow that Ukraine becomes a de facto member of NATO alliance without being admitted into it. Now that puts him into a situation of perceived existential threat that has to be resolved immediately. And I think the military operation, well, it was to a certain extent being planned for many years already, but one of the final phases of operation started in 2020 with this constitutional reform that effectively turned Russia into elector monarchy. And then in 2021, of course, the final decisions were taken. So this is a defensive war, but it is, of course, an imperial war. It is a defensive imperialism, mm-hmm. an imperialism exerted out of this defensive posture. And one thing I want to make very, very clear is that it is not going to end in Ukraine. No way. If Putin is allowed to swallow Ukraine, it is not going to end there. Well, first of all, of course, we have already have Moldova on the military plans of the current operation. There will be definitely an invasion in Moldova in this operation if it is not stopped. And then Putin has already made it clear that he wants a complete withdrawal of the NATO troops from the countries of the former Eastern Bloc, which makes Poland and Baltic states immediately endangered. I mean, I was seeing this war coming for 2 years already, but it became completely obvious to me that it is inevitable in the summer of the last year, when he published this piece about Ukraine, basically claiming that Ukraine has to be under Russian influence one way or another. There's nothing to discuss. And in this very article, he has the idea that Poland is evil and Poland is a constant threat to Russia. There is no doubt to me that Poland is next in line. And the way the Russian military commandment is planning this war, it's been planning this war for a very, very long time. And the way they see this war, of course, they're not waging a war against Ukraine. They simply don't believe Ukraine exists. Still, at this point, they don't believe Ukraine and Ukrainians exist. They're waging a war on the West. And Ukraine is obviously only a first step in this war.
I wonder, Greg, if you can tell us a bit more in what kind of thinking, what kind of ideology this defensive imperialism has its roots. I'm thinking about thinkers like Alexander Dugin, who proposed a kind of ultranationalist but also imperial idea of an imagined Eurasia that's opposed to the liberal post-Second World War order. So is Putin in a circle reading Alexander Dugin or someone else?
You know, it's really difficult to know what Putin and people around him, what they are reading. Because this is a very, very close circle. Putin sits himself in bunker. And there's just a very, very limited number of people who saw him for several years already. Dugin is actually influential among some elite circles. I would at the same time underline that he was politically not very successful. His time was in 2014 because his ideas were used during this annexation campaign. But very soon after that, he was dismissed from the Department of Sociology of the Moscow State University. And I think his influence, even though it is definitely there, it might be a little bit exaggerated. If you want to think of some ideological influence on Putin, I think you'd better read Ivan Ilyin, a Russian, an emigre Russian philosopher who would later become an admirer of fascism. And this is a sort of like very weird mix of imperialism, fascism, also Eurasianism, the glorification of Russian history. Putin actually relies a lot on that, including his crazy doctrine that there is some sort of historical Russia, which goes from God knows when, through Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, Stalin, and then right all the way to Putin. And what is at stake now is the fate of this historical Russia. So I think Ivan Ilyin might be, and he mentioned Ilyin many times, and actually a lot of most crazy things he are saying can be found in Ilyin's writings.
Yeah, and it's really sad and really disgusting to see that Ukrainians have now to suffer because of this imperial vision that someone like Putin has of Russia as a nation. That brings me to the question, do you think that people here in the West have underestimated that historical path or mission that Putin sees himself on, especially the Western left? Some on the left still seem to have difficulty coming to terms with the reality of Russian imperialism, still blaming mostly US imperialism. So what mistakes have been made from your perspective in the past by the Western left? And what does Putin's invasion mean for the anti-militarism and anti-imperialism of the left?
Well, I think this general posture of blaming both sides, even though it has a merit of having a lot of truth in that, but it effectively made the left impotent, because politics is not about making judgment. I mean, if it is about making judgments, then of course you are right. Of course, NATO is an aggressive military bloc, and as a Russian, I mean, I never thought that expanding to the east was a good idea. But it's not about making judgments, it's about action. And if it's about action, then you finally have to give up on this focus on the American imperialism, because there are different sorts of imperialism. And at this point, forgive me, but the sort of imperialism that is coming from Putin is much more dangerous. And one thing that I would like to emphasize is that it is not some sort of like alternative imperialism. It is the same imperialism. Putin is the product of the neoliberal world, of the neoliberal society built in the late 20th and early 21st century. He's just so skilled in mastering it. He understands very well how to behave in this society. He understands the motivation of the people. He is completely sure that people are greedy and everything can be bought and sold. And this is why he was able to corrupt European and American elites, elites all over the world. So the left should simply open up its eyes on the very fact that Putin is a product of this system, is a pinnacle of this system. Mm-hmm. It has raised him, it has fed him up until the very end, when it was already very, very clear how dangerous he was. Still, a lot of a significant part of the elites all over the world was playing this business only, nothing personal, dangerous game. So I think from this position, what should be done right now is support for popular movements, support to the people. The people, the active people in Ukraine, they are now resisting. The people in Belarus, they were resisting for 2 years already. They have to be supported. The people in Russia who are resisting, they have to be supported. First and foremost, of course, Ukrainians who are fighting this terrible war. But in order for that to happen, I think one thing that should be done immediately, and it is a major obstacle to our political action, is a clear and sober judgment on the situation. I mean, clear and sober appraisal of the situation. This is not a local conflict. I know many, many people who are still willing to think of it as an ugly post-Soviet conflict. It would be resolved one way or another. It is not a local conflict. It is not going to end there. It is a great threat to the whole planet, a threat that the planet hasn't seen for decades. and maybe even never in human history because of the nuclear arms, of course. This is a major challenge. And the left, of course, has to live up to those challenges and to think of what are the possible actions rather than making those empty judgments. Sometimes those actions might require coordination or cooperation with the organizations or people whom the left doesn't like, and for a good reason, like NATO, for instance. But at least you can exert some sort of popular pressure on NATO. It is completely impossible to exert any popular pressure on Putin. And for that reason, I think we have to be very, very clear about the challenges and stick to what is really important to us, to stick to defending the popular resistance to this threat.
Yeah, I totally agree. The immediate support of Ukrainians resisting Putin's invasion is super important. But I wonder, Greg, what other possibilities of international solidarity do you see, especially regarding the fate of civil society and democratic opposition in Russia?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think right now some sort of links should be established, because basically what you've been lacking for so long are the links between the civil societies or the people, the international movement. I mean, we're basically, to a certain extent, in the 1914 situation now. And in 1914, at least, there was an international movement. We were lacking this international movement for decades. And this is what made those tyrannical regimes so efficient, because they only had to deal with their own societies and not with some sort of international movement. So right now, we have to think of how this international movement should be established and how Russians and Belarusians, once again, I stress that, should be included in this movement. What are the ways to support it? Mm-hmm. What are the ways to help them? And I think that this is an important resource, yeah, for the global community, the civil society in Russia. And of course, it has to be supported. Yet another thing, and that would probably be my last point, is that this is not going to end well for Russia. There's just no scenario this is going to end well for my country. And of course, I'm terribly disappointed about that. But there's no good solution for Russia here. And Russia is on the verge of some major and, I'm afraid, terrible changes. But it's not going to disappear anyway. There will be another Russia. And I think it is already time to start thinking of how did it happen that Russia became a soil for this sort of regime, for this sort of threat, and what are the measures to be taken in future in order to really include Russia into global community.
Greg, thank you so much for joining me on the Dissens podcast, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you, Lucas.